an egghead to just kind of make a classroom chit-chat small talk for the first couple of minutes. And all the officials, thank you very much for inviting me here to talk, my name is Hui Fong, I'll cut this short. I don't know, I feel very at home here. It's very nice. And when you're at home talking with your friends and family, you normally don't introduce yourself. So we can cut this and make it a bit shorter. I think you kind of have an idea who I am. Now, my understanding is we've sort of had this a couple of months with a bit more focus on some classes. And of these classes, just recently you've been touching on some areas of Mahayana. I think you did you do the Heart Sutra not so long ago?
Yes.
And did you do a bit on like sort of the Mahayana and where the Mahayana came from and things like that?
Yes.
Okay. I'll probably kind of end up doing this again. My apologies. But I think it's the area that I feel most comfortable sharing with, and I think it's always better to talk about something that maybe you have a vague idea about rather than something else.
It was a bit confusing.
Oh, okay.
I was confused.
Okay. From Wikipedia. Okay. I'm not quite Wikipedia. But if you go into a few of the related areas on Wikipedia, you might just find my name as the editor there. Hopefully other good articles. So this is the focus. Now, we're kind of going from 4 up until... We got to finish before 6 because Ajahn Brahm's going to have some time. So I thought maybe we use maybe an hour or a bit, sometime over an hour, and we can look at a couple of areas. I do a very, very quick sort of a recap on the Mahayana, where the Mahayana comes from, then go into the Prajnaparamita, and then we'll see if we can kind of start to tail on into maybe a bit of Nagarjuna, where that fits in there, and then we just open up for Q&A. And I mean, these earlier topics are all Indian Buddhism. This is the area that my own studies are in. I'm a PhD student at the moment, and I'm just kind of finishing off my PhD, and it is in Prajnaparamita, early Mahayana in this area. So I've actually got to make sure I keep it to the point and not too high tech. If I start to get really out there on you and you're like, what the heck is he talking about? Let me know, okay? Seriously, let me know. Otherwise, I don't want to waste your time. Yes?
What monastery do you
use? I'm associated with Huangshan. You probably know Nantian Temple.
Oh,
out at Wollongong?
Okay.
Yes, that's part of the big Fo Guangshan family. Our headquarters, what I call the mothership, is in Taiwan. And we've got like 70, 80 temples, monasteries in Taiwan there, and then we've got another 200 worldwide. But I'm living in Hong Kong. That's really my studies. So does that answer the question?
Yeah.
Okay. So this also is a good point because when we come into the Q&A time, you know, if you also want to talk and have some questions about Chinese Buddhism in general, I'd be happy to share with that too. It's not my area of study as a sort of a scholarly type, but you live in the monastery for years, obviously you have an idea about what's going on. So, you know, that Q&A time we can open up pretty broad, but that's all up to you here. Okay, so the first thing then is just having a little bit of a recap on the Mahayana and where the Mahayana comes from. Now, if we start from what the Mahayana kind of says about itself, you know, it's always good to, you know, when you ask one to know where someone's from, you ask them themselves, you don't ask someone else. It's quite an interesting tale. The first, you know, the teachings themselves are presented as though it's the Buddha teaching them to disciples and so on and so forth. When we actually look at our first sort of hard evidence of the Mahayana, probably the earliest is we've got a few, they're not really explicit, but they're kind of implicit, kind of hinting at it, things like some engravings in India. They include things like a donation to a monastery or something like that, and the terms and phrases in particular, you know, so that all living beings may be happy, this sort of thing. These are some of the earliest things of ideas, records associated with the Mahayana. These start probably about the 1st century BC up to about the 5th century But there's actually very few of them up until the 5th century. Very few. And very few of them are explicit at all. You know, you don't see engravings of a whole Mahayana sutra on stone so that you can date that stone to that time. So that's actually quite interesting, as opposed to, say, other forms of Buddhism. You've got the Asokan edicts, you know, the things that King Asoka left. We can date those well, and you can read them, and okay, that clearly matches some teachings that the Buddha gave. It's what they call hard evidence on the ground. The second, that's the first one. The second one is translations that were brought into China. And these translations, the first texts that were brought into China weren't Mahayana texts. But starting in the late 2nd century, we had at least two translations of definitely Mahayana sutras, you know, sutras that themselves are explicitly Mahayana, so it's very obvious. And then over the next few centuries, they start to increase. They become more and more and more and more frequent as the Chinese themselves had more interest in Buddhism and, you know, actively tried to bring all this stuff in there. But even in, you know, this late 2nd century, it wasn't... just because one monk brings a couple of books in his bag into some other country doesn't necessarily mean much, right? It doesn't necessarily mean that all the monks in that area are Mahayanist or they all follow this teaching. It's easy to see one inscription that seems to hint of Mahayana or to have one sutra that's brought in. I mean, it only takes one sutra to be brought in, to be translated and spread to start a huge tradition. It's easy to make a mistake and think that... Oh, well, at that time, and this is what scholars used to do. Oh, well, you know, probably from the 2nd century up to the 5th century, well, you know, Mahayana was the dominant form of Buddhism in India. Nowadays, scholars go, it just wasn't. It wasn't. If it was, we'd have many more other things pointing at that, and we simply don't. So even up until about the 5th century, you've got what we call the, you know, sectarian Buddhism, all these different schools. I know have you covered... I mean, you don't want to cover all these schools. You'll go crazy, believe me. It's the thicket of views. You know, the Buddha uses that term, the jungle of views. Sectarian Buddhism is the jungle of views. But so be very careful in there. You'll die in there. I'm dying in there right now on my PhD. But at least you have the idea that there were all these different schools and they did have a lot of opinions. Okay, that's an important point to keep in mind. They were the dominant traditions all the way up until about the 5th century. Yeah? And it's only at that time... Now, by the 5th century, Mahayana was already pretty much what the Chinese were doing with their Buddhism. At first, they also got this Shravastivada Abhidharma-type stuff and some Shravastivada... You know the Shravastivada? One of those other schools? It's in some ways, quite close to the Theravada because they had an Abhidharma. In some ways, but in other ways, you know, it's very different. And they also had some meditation manuals. Yeah, they're not necessarily even sutra, but like meditation manuals, anapana, you know, other techniques like this. These came in early into China, but then by the 5th century, the Chinese were already, oh, we're definitely into Mahayana, and they were taking this tradition. They probably took it up much earlier than they did in India. Yeah, but then from that time in India, it did start to grow and grow and grow. So that's what we have from the hard evidence, you know, that we know. You can kind of say, well, we do know, in fact, that at this time this text was brought in, that it's hard evidence. It's, you know, the things you've got to work in. Then the next step is, well, okay, well, where did it come from in the first place? That's the real big question, sort of the origins of the Mahayana. And then this is where things tend to get a bit more theoretical. You've got to work on the evidence that you have and try to backtrace it. A long time ago... you know, Western scholarship of Buddhism is a pretty weird beast. And at one point, from people like D.T. Suzuki, you know, D.T. there are two Suzukis. One's the Zen master, the other's a kind of more of a scholar. He wrote a lot of books about Mahayana Buddhism, and they gobbled that up in the USA and Europe. And anything that D.T. Suzuki said about Mahayana, that was Mahayana in India. But he was just representing... 20th century, 19th century, 20th century Japanese ideas about it. And they spend all this time, you know, trying to work out, oh, the Japanese have like a Pure Land school. So they used to think that, oh, in India there was like a Pure Land school, you know, in India at that time. Yeah, they had these ideas of like the Tentai school, you know, oh, that there was like, and they tried to track these things down in India. And the Japanese, I don't know, they probably spent thousands and millions of dollars and they never found it. Because it just wasn't there, basically. So then there was a bit more of progression into the next one. And then, this is, there's this very interesting theory came out by Hirokara Akira. Okay? That's what's called A History of Indian Buddhism. That's an English translation. It was originally in Japanese. And he came up with a very powerful theory. And it was basically it had a couple of aspects to this theory. The first one was basically the importance of what we might call Buddha biographical literature. Okay, but by literature, this could also include oral transmission. And I believe, Bande, you've already talked about these Jatakas and these Avadanas and this literature. It was, I think we can be pretty sure, throughout the whole of Indian Buddhism, incredibly popular. You know, people go to the temple and, you know, you ask the monk for a teaching. You know, if you're looking for a bottom line teaching, one of the most inspiring stories is you tell the life of the Buddha. And it's great. And even old Buddhas still love to hear it, and I still love to hear it. You know, we love it. It's great stuff. But it was huge. It was, all the different schools had their own versions, and they were slightly different versions. And so you can see that on, you know, as time from the Buddha himself passes on, there was no, you know, he didn't become less popular in time. He became more unpopular in time. And not just more popular in time, he became more in time. He became more than a Buddha. He became an Anuttara Samyak Sambuddha, right? And this, and you can see it in the Pali commentarial tradition. And you see it in all the other traditions. The Buddha goes from being probably someone who was fairly tall to being like 12 foot tall. Literally. I know, was it, can you remember how tall they measured him? 20 spans high or something. Literally, astronomical proportions. His features, you know, he has the 32 marks of the great man, yeah? The Mahalakana Sutta talks about the 32 marks. You know, they became indelibly fixed in that way. You know, his ears really did touch his shoulders. And his tongue really could curl up and touch his hairline. You know? And these are the ideas. And at least for some of the schools, some of the Mahasamgika schools, there was this idea, what they call the Chittism, which basically means that, whereas we think of the Buddha as a human being who came to the world and became enlightened, and we say, you know, well, where does the Buddha, you know, then he attains parinibbana, you know, where does he go? We know that's one of the questions that this wasn't answered, right? Where does the Buddha go after parinibbana? I'm not going to get into that discussion. But it became this idea that really the Buddha wasn't really even there in the first place. I mean, you can say that in the Theravada in a certain level, can't we? You know, because you can't identify any of the five aggregates as being the Buddha himself. But this went on to a kind of brought onto another level. This basically this idea that the Buddha's whole appearance in the world and and in particular, his problems and anything that might have been perceived as a fault or a shortcoming was merely just a show and merely just a play. Yeah? So, for example, well, if he was really so clever, why on earth would he waste 6 years of his life practicing austerities? Right? It's an interesting question. And we say, well, that was a traditional spiritual practice in his time, blah, blah, blah. But some would say, well, he was really already enlightened. He already knew they were wrong. But he wanted to show, look, see, I did it and then I quit it so that others practicing would also quit them and then take up the true path. This was like their apologetics. The Buddha's other sufferings, you know, a couple of times he suffers from a bad back, right? And he lies down and takes a rest and lets Anand give the teaching. You know, we have those in the suttas themselves. The whole Saka clan being basically wiped out. Wow, if he's got such great virtue, you know, great merit, and his whole family, his whole clan gets destroyed, why? So a lot of these came out as one particular group in the Mahayana in particular, the sort of apologetics, that really isn't the Buddha. These are just shows. These are just displays to show impermanence, to show the law of karma, you know, to give people an opportunity to make offerings of medicine to the Buddha. If the Buddha himself was perfectly healthy and never needed medicine, then other monastics might think, well, the Buddha never took medicine, I should never take it too. But of course, our bodies are not as strong as his. Therefore, they argued, in order that other later monastics would feel that it's okay to take medicine, the Buddha pretends to be sick, so someone can make an offering to him as an example. So this was a form of apologetics. You know, those people say, oh, you're teaching the Buddha, but he got sick too, you know. But our teacher never gets sick, you know. So our origin must be better. You can imagine there was in the spiritual marketplace, you know, and it's not just nowadays that spirituality is a commodity. I'm sure it was right from the word go. People had to come up with a sort of apologetics as their own explanation. Where do I get onto this topic? That is related to parts of the Mahayana, but not all the Mahayana. So this biographical literature of the Buddha meant that the ideal of the Buddha was held higher than the rest of the Sangha for many schools. Yeah? This became more and more the case. The Buddha was this ultimate ideal. Now, this is one of Hirakawa's arguments. The next one he goes on to is he has this idea that, and the first part's pretty much not a problem. After the Buddha passes away, we know in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, yeah, you've read this text, right? At the very end of the text, you see that the various Katiya clans and some other Brahmin clans will come along and they fight over the relics of the Buddha, right? Right, after they cremate the body and they get these different relics and they're like, well, I'm his clan and we're his clan, and we break it up and the Sangha goes, okay, you guys do whatever you want to do. We're out of here. They're fighting over it. And they take these relics. These relics are then set up in these stupas, okay? You won't go into the history of stupas. But these become then symbolic of the Buddha himself, of the Buddha's body. And they represent and they stand for the Buddha. Some people like to think this was universal, but without getting into a huge other sidetrack, it's really interesting to keep in mind that up until the Buddha's day, okay, let's start to use the funky little whiteboard thing here. Okay. Can you see through the Venerable Jive? Okay, what is this? What is this? Ta-da!
India.
Brilliant. Wow. Thanks. You filled me with confidence. And this is?
Himalaya.
And that is? Ta-da, thank you. You appreciate my artistic brilliance. Not. Okay. So where's the Buddha from? The Buddha's kind of like probably around here-ish, really, isn't it? This is kind of his home territory, right? Yep. Okay. It's really interesting. Okay, then we also have the Indus, right? Which is kind of really cool. We also have the Indus, which is also another major river. This is something that's very modern scholarship. So you probably won't believe me. If you've read a few books, you're probably thinking that I'm making this up. But there's a lot of scholars now saying this idea. At the time of the Buddha and before the Buddha, this is Brahmin territory. This is where the Brahmins live, right? With their Vedic culture. Yeah, I'm sure you've done some class on that, so I won't go into that. But and we're going to get two pens. This area is Magadha and Kosala, right? These are the names of these countries at the time. They're not Brahmin. Their religious culture is Shramana culture. Now, the reason I say this is that a lot of books you get on Buddhist history, and you even get this feeling if you just read the suttas, because it always says, it'll say like, you know, the world with its Shamanas and Brahmanas, and its Maras and Devas and Brahmas, right? And they give them the whole list. And it kind of puts the two on, you know, there's some religious practitioners are Shamanas and others are Brahmanas. And the idea was earlier, this was an early thing, was that basically the whole of India is Brahmanical culture, and the Shramans were this new rebelling religious movement against it. And I used to think that for many years too, until I started to read, I won't go into it, it's too scholarly, we'll ditch that. But basically, the point is this, it's this area of Magadha, and this area around here is Shramana, and it's a different culture, and this is Brahmanic Vedic culture, it's a different culture. The differences, the point I want to make is, the difference is the idea of stupas and putting the cremated relics of a holy person into the stupa and worshipping it is Shramana culture. The Brahmins thought this was repulsive because it was worshipping a part of a dead body, and a dead body in Vedic culture is ritually impure. They thought it was repulsive. Now, at the Buddha's time, it was like this, but there were Brahmins probably around here, but it wasn't really their territory. They were just kind of poking into the Magadhan territory, so there was a bit of conflict there. Yeah, and the Buddha is from the Shramana culture. It's a different culture. This culture is where the Jains come from. And you know the six heterodox teachers, of which Jainism is one, right? They're from this culture. And some of their ideas include cyclic existence, like life after life after life after life after life. Okay, you're doing the Shramanapala Sutta, right? Okay, well, I'll leave all that for there because they're explaining great detail there. The Brahmins didn't really have that. They had this life and the next life. And the way to get to the next life was that if the priest does the ritual fire sacrifice correctly at your death. So it was kind of different. It was quite different ideas. But very soon after the Buddha, these mingled very quickly. And it was after the Buddha that the sutras were all compiled. So it was in a time when these cultures are already mingling together. So they seem to just be blended in together. But it seems that they weren't quite like that. Okay, there's another reason why I mentioned this, but I'll get back to it in a moment. So they worship these stupas. So then these stupas become very important focal points for the Buddhist community, right? They are the focal point. And if you go to, I don't know about Thailand, but from what I've heard about Sri Lanka, probably the biggest and fanciest temple is where they've got the biggest relic. Yeah? Would that kind of be about right?
The
truth relic. Okay.
The old stupas, especially, the Jetavan stupa is the biggest, religious monument of any kind anywhere. It's
wow.
Even the Great Pyramid.
What about the Indonesian one? Is that the biggest? I thought the area
was maybe. But Borobudur itself is a stupa. So these were the main focal point. Now his theory, he says, at this time, and many of the vineyards of different schools say that that an offering made to the stupa is not an offering made to the Sangha. And he makes a real big deal out of this. And he says, so then the Sangha were kind of on one part, but the stupa was another. So then he makes this big argument that the people looking after the stupa were not the monastic Sangha. They weren't the Bhikkhu Bhikkhuni Sangha. And then, so this is a big point, and it's this point that later gets thrown out in the last couple of decades. And he says, and then on these stupas you have, these frescoes of paintings of the Buddha's life, major events, Jataka stories, yeah? So the focal points, these people come along, and then this is where they hear much about the idea of the Bodhisattva. The Bodhisattva, his life, and these Jataka stories, da-da-da-da. And it raises up this ideal. So this is like, and then they took this ideal. These people that were not fully ordained monastics, but they weren't just lay people either with regular jobs, because they were specifically, it was kind of like their job was to look after the stupa and to basically tell the tale of the Buddha and his past lives. He says, and these people became the first bodhis, the first Mahayanists. Now, this idea is kind of being debunked. And to be a bit more facetious, the way it's debunked is basically saying, but a lot of the Japanese like this idea. They debunk it and say, this is basically because the Japanese themselves, their modern tradition, does not have a Bhikshu Bhikshuni ordination. They have, whether you call them priests or whatever, but they are specialist Buddhists. And so this was kind of, they read the ancient Mahayana in the light of their present tradition. We're neither lay people nor monastics. Yeah? So this was kind of the idea. So they've got a lot of criticism for that. Because mainly their idea hangs on just a couple of passages and very little information. But on the contrary, what we actually did, the more present situation is something like this. That it was actually, on one hand, yes, these centers were based around the stupas. But because they were based around stupas, they became, they weren't Dharma centers and they weren't meditation centers. They were festival centers. They became places where festivals are held, and where you wind up the juggernaut, where you wind out the deity and you parade it around, and they would do all these things. And so the monastic community that was associated with it, the stupa's there, but basically it's kind of right next to or right by the vihara, and then kind of this whole town and village builds up around it and so on and so forth, and that You know, it became a powerful religious centre, but probably not very much in the terms of actual practice or spirituality. It was too busy. It was too focused on just endlessly teaching on one hand, but the new theory says, but this is not the Mahayana. In fact, this is what the proto-Mahayanists actually despised. And on the other hand, there were a group of people that said, well, yeah, but the Buddha himself didn't live in that way. How did the Buddha live? He lived striving in the jungle, right? And he was a meditator, and he was a meditator par excellence. He was amazing. And the early Sangha, too, were like this. But these people, they had these ideas, and they were quite critical of this, I wouldn't say debased, but not exactly living up to the really high ideals of the Buddha, this community, who had the power of the stupa. And so you see, and what they wanted to do is they wanted to live in the forest and the jungles and focus on their meditation. Okay, but their meditation is still a bit different from perhaps what you'd be practicing here. I'll get to that in a moment. And we have more evidence than Hirakawa's theory on this one. Basically, the evidence is twofold. A lot of the early Mahayana sutras say things like, oh, you get a lot of merit by offering at stupas. You get so much merit. But you get even much, 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 much more by practicing these teachings, these Mahayana teachings, or just basically practicing in general. Giving even to a stupa is a meritorious deed, but it's, you know, there's many more, even more meritorious deeds, right? There's kind of a hierarchy. I'm sure you kind of know how it works. And there's probably even some conflict there. There's probably even some conflict there with these groups. So who were these people? But it does seem that, okay, so they were instead in the forest and the jungle doing their meditation, but their meditation is quite a bit different. Because in a certain sense they were perhaps living in a polar opposition or some sort of, at times it would have been antagonism with the stupa-based community, they also had this great ideal of the Bodhisattva too. So they still had that idea. They didn't reject those teachings and that Buddha biography literature. They didn't reject that at all. In fact, they were really into it too. They just didn't want the sort of the stupa-based lifestyle that was nearly ritualized. So in this way, they were probably very small, very few groups, yeah, and probably, you know, isolated individuals out in the forests. Now then the question is, so what were they doing? Now at this time they weren't so much Mahayanists, but they were people that had the idea that our ideal and our exemplar is the Buddha himself. So if we're going to follow anyone, we're not going to follow those monks over there. And we're not even, because remember this Buddha biographical literature makes the difference between even say the Buddha and Mahakasapa or Sariputta larger. I mean, if you look in the suttas themselves, you know, the example where the Buddha has Mahakasapa sit right next to him and says, you're my equal in all these ways, right? And he says that just as I turn the wheel of Dharma, Sariputra turns the wheel of Dharma too. You don't feel that there's this huge gap. This biographical literature raised the gap. So these people with this ideal were very much focused on the Buddha, which includes all the past lives of Jatakas. And some of those entail these superhuman feats of virtue, giving one's whole life, giving one's whole body to save a small pigeon. You know, it's worthwhile if you're really compassionate. So this literature would have us believe. And so what they're doing, they were basically taking early suttas, their own teachings and understanding of the Dharma would have been based on early literature, plus a huge heavy dose of this this Buddha biographical literature, plus a strong intention to meditate. And this is, in fact, what we see in the earliest strata of Mahayana suttas when they come out. There's quite a few categories. In many ways, the stuff that's been translated into English is not very representative. Most of the stuff that we find in English or French or German represents more, first of all, it represents what was popular in Japanese Buddhism in the 20th century. Because that's when we got it, basically, right? Then it started to represent Tibetan Buddhism, which is even later still. And even if we were going to say, well, what's even popular in Chinese Buddhism in the 20th century or the 21st century, it would probably in many ways be pretty similar to the Japanese. But that doesn't have anything necessarily to do with what these first Mahayana groups were doing. Yep. There's a huge gap in between. But we do have some of these translated into Chinese. A lot of them we don't have in Sanskrit. They were lost. The very fact that they were lost is itself argumentum ex silentio, like arguing from the absence of something, that the Mahayana, when it started, wasn't that big and it wasn't that popular. If it was really popular, we'd have Sanskrit manuscripts all over the place, right? And we'd be pulling them out left, right, and center, but we don't. Why? Because there were probably very few of them in the first place. But like I said, some went into China and they got picked up. Now, this one here, this book here is very interesting. It's called A Few Good Men. The title, and it's the Bodhisattva Path according to a sutra called The Inquiry of Ugra, Ugra Paripircha. It's by a scholar called Jan Attia. She's presently in Japan. She's pretty amazing scholar. Still alive. She's from the USA, Indiana. And it's very interesting. She deliberately picked what seems to be one of the earliest Mahayana sutras. This teaching is definitely not popular at all in China. I mean, Chinese wouldn't have a clue this even exists. But when you look at it when it first appeared and its contents, it's very interesting. And basically, the content paints a picture of there's a young man called Ugra. Now, Ugra appears in Pali as Uga, U-G-G-A, even in the Pali. So this is an historical figure, yeah? He's a layperson who, according to the sutta, goes and, you know, inquires of the Buddha some teachings. And it begins where, you know, he just basically gets this instruction. And the early instruction is pretty basic instruction. A lot of it is about how the layperson should behave themselves when they go to the monastery. You know, and it doesn't really have anything much that's contrary to early Buddhism at all. But it gives quite a bit of detail on the different. Then it goes a bit deeper on, you know, that he's a very devout lay practitioner. Obviously, put, you know, a lot of time into the community. And it goes through and he says, you know, there's these different venerables and different roles in the community. And they include, for example, you know, you've got like you've got the abbot, you've got the guest monk or the guest nun who looks after the guests, and, you know, I'm sure you've got your different roles and different jobs. But then it goes on to, and then it has this point of, there's also the forest meditators. Like, there's others that don't have job. Their job, you just go meditate. That's their job. There's also another group who are basically these bodhisattva aspirants. They're not just, they're the meditators. They practice the 12 dhutanga, right? The Buddhist style asceticism. They don't, one meal a day, they only beg, three robes, they don't lie down at night. That, you know, this usually associated with pretty hardcore ascetic, you know, practices. And these were the bodhisattva aspirants, were this very tiny minority. But they're still kind of basically associated with this regular monastery. In the sense that at first the Mahayana was not a separate group at all. It was, as the book says, a few good men, a very small minority within their community who had that aspiration. Okay. And then it goes through the teachings about Ugra, and, you know, finally, you know, it says that you should pay respect to these equally. You know, don't, you know, sort of become arrogant that, oh, you know, the meditator monks are somehow better, so I should give more respect to them than these other monks or nuns who are doing other tasks and whatever. Which is, once again, it's very interesting. It shows very much that it's part of mainstream culture, and mainstream Buddhist culture. And then it goes on at the end that Ugra himself ordains and enters into the Sangha. This is the first strata of Mahayana teachings, of Mahayana texts. And nowadays, there's a few more of these things are starting to come out. And then in addition, like I said, this is these early stream of Mahayana sutras. There's also another huge section in the Chinese Buddhist canon, which very few of them have ever been looked at or translated. And the Chinese classify them as Samadhi sutras. They've got their own special category. And they were some of the earliest stuff that came into China. And once again, they came in through the Silk Road, through, I don't know if you know how, you know, it comes up here and through the Silk Road, and then it goes to north and south of Silk Road, through Kucha and Khotan. Khotan's in the south. And then it comes down into Chang'an and central China. It had gone through the Central Asian process. And this is where the earliest couple of centuries of stuff came into China, 2nd to 5th century. There's a whole big section called Samadhi Sutras. And the name itself is interesting, right? These are based on a particular samadhi. They're based on a meditation practice. But like I say, these samadhis aren't, they're not anapana, and they're not metta, and they're not karuna, and they're not asubha, and they're not, you know, they're kind of different. So what are they? Well, some of them are like your very standard practices, but they kind of, I don't know, they kind of then go off on their own a bit. You know, breath meditations, but they're not just breath meditations. You know, it then starts to draw into these levels and, you know, visualizing this whole air element, you know, from the whole, basically like almost from the whole universe, drawing it in through one's body and this sort of thing. Almost in the sense that it's taken original teaching. People have been practicing it and then they've been working on this practice, you know, for a couple of hundred years. And so, you know, as teachings do, they develop their own ways and their own style of doing it. They add a bit here and they drop a bit there. And sometimes it does get pretty, you know, literally imaginative, but this is what they were practicing. And these they were then written up. The usual idea is that they were taught orally, but at some point they were basically written down as though they're teachings from the Buddha. Okay, I'm not sure how much detail you've gone into things like the compilation of the early canon, but when you actually look at even how the early canon is formed, you know, it's not that different in some ways. It's just later, so the contents are later and have gone off in further development. And then you get a few other ones of these sorts of Samadhi Sutras. Some of the other early ones include ones called the Sharangama, another one's called the Samadhi Raja. And also one of these, we can probably say that the Prajnaparamita is also one of these examples, because the earliest part of the Prajnaparamita talks about a specific samadhi. That's its whole crux. So at first it seemed that they were developing in these communities. At this point, they might not even have used the term Mahayana, but they definitely used the term Bodhisattva or Bodhisattva, okay, because that comes from this Buddha biographical literature. Okay. It's not sure exactly where they started to use the independent term. And it's quite possible that simply because this whole, you know, the social context so described in terms of there are these strong groups based around there's one other part I should need to add. And because these groups, these other mainstream groups are often based around the stupa, which is the body of the Buddha, right? Literally. You know, like the term Buddha Dhatu in Pali refers to the stupa, the sharira of the Buddha, the relics of the Buddha. You know, and it is the sharira, it is the body of the Buddha. Then you've got these perhaps slightly marginalized, but maybe they kind of marginalized themselves because they didn't want this lifestyle. They wanted to focus on their own practice of meditation with the Buddha themselves as this ideal. Now, why did I bring up this point? Oh. So rather than saying, oh, well, you get all this merit from making offerings to the stupa, you would get more merit from reciting this teaching. Now, later on, this becomes, you get more merit from reciting this Mahayana Sutra. This is how it would become a couple of centuries later. But early on, the point is, look, you'd get more merit if you went out there and did some meditation and, you know, and probably hold our precepts than simply by giving to the stupa. That's kind of the basic gist. There are reasons for this. In a culture, in a religious culture that puts a huge amount of import on the generation of merit, well, you know, it comes down to, if you're considered to be a monastic that's got poor sila and poor practice, the devotees know that giving to you doesn't lead to much merit, right? They want to give to Ajahn Brahms because he's a great practitioner. If you give to me, you don't get much merit out of it, so you might as well give to him instead, right? So you kind of have to, like I was saying, you kind of have to show you there's more merit in our practice here than there is in that practice over there. Yeah. So this was what I mean by that in some ways marginalized. Some scholars have made a huge big deal out of this. Maybe they're right, I don't know. Sometimes I don't think it's that much of a deal, but it's just something interesting to keep in mind. Perhaps this marginalization also at a certain point started to lead to some internal tension. Yeah? And marginalization as well, between this internal tension, but also the fact, like I said, if you've got someone who's just like, you know, if you had a monastery and everyone was just kind of like pretty slack, and then somebody comes along and they're like, I'm going to meditate like the Buddha, and they're out there, and you know, and everyone knows after a few months that they purely uphold these Dutangas, and this person really does have samadhi, you know, and they are really an amazing practitioner. It also generates a little jealousy, right? You know, by the slack practitioners, because, you know, jealousy, you know, they don't have the practice to overcome these afflictions and whatever. So that's another form of tension that might have come up as well. Now, this context is not necessarily in one place. A lot of the times people were trying to work out, where does it come, where did the Mahayana start? And this was like a really big question, and no one really had it. Clue, quite frankly, and we don't have enough evidence to really be that sure. So there's a couple of different theories. One basically says, look, it was in one place, where we're not, we don't know. Another one says, look, this basic tendency could have, in a sense, been happening simultaneously in lots of different places. Yeah? And the more I think about that, you know, the dynamics, the sort of dynamics is not, It's you know, even the modern Buddhism, you know, what I've just been saying, it doesn't necessarily sound like it's 2,000 years ago. I mean, that could be quite a few places, even around Sydney, who knows. So they had this idea that there could have been all over different places in India different expressions of this basic ideal, which is the ideal of the Bodhisattva as this, you know, that's our real ideal, and everyone else is kind of secondary, not really good. And this is a good reason. One of the good points about this idea, I'm not saying it's correct, is that it helps us understand why so many of these Mahayana sutras, they had the same ideal, the ideal I just described, but doctrinally, when it comes down to the doctrinal kind of technical stuff, they often have quite different ideas, and you know, they don't necessarily disagree. If they disagreed in the sutra, it would mean that they acknowledge that there's another group like that, and then, you know, like the sutra's giving a polemic argument against them. They're not like that, but they give, this is our explanation, but then another sutra gives quite a different one, and another one. Like, who, what the hell are these early Mahayanas? They're all like totally stupid and changing their mind every 10 years? Maybe, but probably these ideas were coming out in different Nikayan schools of Buddhism, right? And as we know, by this time already, these different schools of Buddhism had their own different theories about a lot of different things. Yeah? Do dharmas exist in the past, present, and future, or do dharmas only exist in the present? What is emptiness? Is there a pudgala or is there not a pudgala? Is there this intermediate existence between my death in this life and then my rebirth in the next life? These are all the questions that the different schools are arguing, and some Mahayana sutras have this one, and some have that one, and some have them kind of like quite scattered. So this idea that, and they had these teachings, they started to write them down at some point, and they also encouraged other people to copy them out. And you'll see that in a lot of, if you've ever read the Diamond Sutra, there's a there, not every second page, it's a bit facetious. But, you know, a few times in the text it's saying, you know, write out the text. You get a lot of merit from writing out the text. Why does a group need to emphasize writing out a text all the time? One reason, you know, there could be other reasons. Help yourself to a reason if you've got a better reason. Could be that if you're a marginalized group and, you know, you're not sure that you can preserve this teaching, quickly write it out. Write it out now. You know, if you look at the first writings of the text in Sri Lanka, when were they first written down? It was in a time of drought, when they were seriously afraid that they were going to lose teachings because the Banaka reciters who had memorized the teachings were actually dying of starvation. It's like, if we don't write these down, if that group of monks, this group of monks over here, they're the only people who have memorized these particular texts, if they all die, we lose the Dharma. Oh, hell. Oh, man. That's serious stuff. Quickly write it out. Preserve it. So this same attitude that you see and some of these early Mahayana teachers reflects that too. A group that's kind of threatened, that's kind of in danger, how exactly, why exactly, hard to say. Probably just simply small numbers, a minority, a tiny minority, that wasn't very well accepted by the other groups. So rather than becoming cults that focused around these stupas, which is what some other Buddhist groups were, they became cults focused around a text. Now, a cult focused around text is much easier than a cult focused around a stupa, because texts are much more portable. Yeah? You want to take your massive, your Sanchi, you know, you take your huge Sanchi stupa and go on pilgrimage. It's a joke. You know, the idea itself is just simply ridiculous. But if your teaching is written down on some pieces of parchment, right, or some ola leaves or leather or birch bark or whatever they used in different parts of India and Asia at that time, it's pretty portable, right? You can write it out and you go, you found someone who's got the teaching and they copy it out. And then you're portable and you go. And also remember, because one of the ideas in it is to spread the Dharma, just as the Buddha himself, you know, for the wheel of the world, for the benefit of the many people, go out there and turn the wheel of Dharma, right? This idea is early on in the Buddha's biographical literature, just after he becomes enlightened and teaches the five bhikkhus, and then there's the 60, right? Yasa and all his friends. And then what does he say? Go, 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 right? Everywhere. You're already enlightened. Go everywhere. Well, that's what the Buddha did after he became enlightened. We've been practicing. I don't know if they thought they were enlightened or not. Probably they didn't. But they would have had the similar approach, right? Scatter. But you can scatter because your teachings are portable. Which meant that they then gained prominence not in the heartland of Buddhism. Of course, the heartland of Buddhism by this time is already pretty huge, actually. It's already about this bit, you know, right up here is already the heartland. Where did they find prominence? If you're already in this heartland, you go to all these other places, there's already stupas and established groups. And when you go to these other places and you start teaching these new teachings, the local people go, I don't know that sutta. So where do you go? You go to the borders, right? Okay, the heartland, including Sri Lanka at that time already. So you go to the borders. Where are the borders? Probably some go this way. The others end up going through the Silk Road. So that's why it sort of spread very quickly to the borders and into China. And so in a certain sense, the rate at which the Chinese picked it up was probably very close behind how it appeared in India. But because in China they didn't have the earlier teachings at that time to make a comparison and go, I think your Dharma is a little bit weird. It doesn't match what we've got. It became even stronger there, yeah, than it would have in India at that time. Until much later, when it had already percolated back, and the whole ideal had become kind of different. And several centuries later, it became such that the Bodhisattva ideal, it became such a powerful ideal. Because, you know, all these schools are like, well, yeah, the Buddha really is he is just so much better than everyone else, that schools were then hard put not to accept it and not to incorporate this into their system. And this is why you see, in probably about, I don't know, when's Dhammapala? 7th century? 7th or 8th century, maybe? For the Sri Lankan, for the Mahavihara Pali Theravada commentarial tradition, you know, okay, Buddha Gosha, then a couple of centuries after Buddha Gosha, Dhammapala comes up, you know, he basically brings this ideal of the Shravaka Bodhi, Pratyeka Buddha Bodhi, and then, you know, Sannyasin Bodhi is different levels. At this time, schools had to take it on. If you didn't start to at least have some explanation for the system, everyone would, you guys don't even, you know, you guys aren't up to play with these latest ideals. And then after that time in India, it's not so much that Mahayana became the dominant tradition, but every tradition had a form of Mahayana and its own explanation for the difference between the Buddha and whoever else. Okay, but as we look, if you want to even compare that to the early suttas, yeah, sometimes there's a big gap, but you have to keep up with the play. Okay, that's, oh my lord, that's already 50 minutes on early Mahayana stuff. Before I then go into the next sort of topic, any questions on that? I'm not sure if I've just said something that you've already learnt like a week ago and you're just being like really polite and like, are you still going on? Okay. Or if I've actually maybe given you some new ideas. But do you have any questions about that or anything you'd like to know? Yeah.
As far as I know, which I know very, very, very little, is that the the like the sutras and themes that we study, the Pali ones, mm-hmm. that they also went to China and got translated in Chinese.
Yes.
Did that happen later then?
That happened in the late 4th century up into the early 6th century. So, now, I don't want to give you a horrible answer that's going to be more information than you want. The earliest, look at that, the very earliest stream, 2nd century, 3rd century, and 4th century in China, first it was Shaivastivada stuff, Abhidharma kind of stuff, and kind of individual early sutras, but not a whole, not a whole like Nikaya, like those Bhikkhu Bodhi translations, but just individual couple. And then as time went on, a bit, you know, into maybe like the 3rd century and the 4th century, more Mahayana stuff. By the 5th century, mainly Mahayana stuff. And from that time, it was, you know, almost all the way through, it was almost all mainly Mahayana stuff. But there were a couple of specific people who brought in those versions of the Agamas, mainly from schools that were around here. A couple of those are Shaivastivada up here, and then the Dharmaguptas who were just over here. So, does that answer your question? Yeah?
So they did get taken in.
They did get taken in, but, yeah, so to the Chinese, to, you know, they had more Mahayana stuff before they had these Agamas. So, you know, the idea of, you know, we commonly use it in our early Buddhist teachings and then the later Mahayana. To the Chinese, they didn't read it like that at all. What do you mean earlier? We got these ones first, right? So, to them, and I was listening with Venerable Jay here about this, it's quite interesting in that nowadays we have a much clearer idea of when they appeared historically. When you see how things appear historically, you can see how they develop. It's impermanence, independent origination, all over again. Okay, and then for the Indian schools, they would have been in the same situation, right? Because, well, we had these first, and then a couple of centuries later we get this new stuff. You get something new, you've got to compare it with your earlier stuff, right? And you make an assessment on that basis. But for the Chinese, it kind of came all together, but, you know, its order didn't follow its development in India. So the way they had to then explain, some of these things are like really different, you know, really different stuff. How do we work out, how do we try to understand that? And you've kind of got two approaches. One approach is an exclusivist approach. You say, oh, some of it's real Buddhism and the other stuff isn't Buddhism. It's fake, it's bogus. But, you know, most Buddhists tend to be a bit hesitant, you know. You don't want to say a real teaching's bogus. You know, that's slandering the Dharma. That's some real heavy, nasty karma, right? You want to be a bit careful about saying that. So, and also just generally Chinese attitude. The other approach, what's nicer? An inclusivist approach, whereby you say, okay, it's all Dharma, but then we've still got to think of some other way of explaining the differences. And that's when the Chinese came up with their own doctrinal classification systems, which in a certain sense could feel the historical development, but rather than seeing it as historical development from the Buddha and after the Buddha's time, as in literally what took about 800 years to come out of India, we can assign that to 45 years of the Buddha's life. You know what I mean? And so with one exception, they thought that these agamas, what we call now early teachings, is what the Buddha first taught earlier in his teaching career, and then later on, he taught the Mahayana. So that's kind of the Chinese systems, and that's how they always read it, you know, traditionally. Is that answering your question? Okay.
Just to clarify, I'm not sure if this is what you're implying, but it wasn't exactly the Pali texts that were taken to China, but the parallel collections from other Buddhist schools, yeah? So the Pali texts themselves never went to China.
Mm-hmm.
The arguments were pretty much similar, belonging to other schools and various.
Yeah. Now, we were just talking about that just before the class as well, and that's quite an interesting topic. And I'm also very happy to talk about that. We're running at like an hour, but so I could continue on with some Prajnaparamita, or I'm also happy to take two steps back and go the other way if you like, and talk about comparative Buddhist literature in the early literature and stuff.
Probably
but
best to go to the Prussian Pragmatic Magazine because the comparative stuff is what we're doing already.
Okay, well, I thought that might be the best. Okay, cool. Okay, so we're talking about these different Mahayana, early Mahayana texts, and some of them were sort of like these samadhis or based on some particular samadhi practice. Now, it became the case that, and so some of the earliest stuff that was brought into China and translated was this Prajnaparamita literature, Prajnaparamita text. And by the time they were brought in, they were already pretty big, you know. They were, you know, to translate, it's like 200 pages into English. So they weren't like these five-page suttas. They were, you know, they were big, chunky texts. And of all the different Mahayana literature that grew and developed, some became more popular, some became less popular, and it just so happened that this Prajnaparamita literature became a very powerful theme, a very powerful literature as a literary genre, even within the Mahayana itself. So let's have a look into that. Now, the first stuff that came into China, they first got a version in the 2nd century, and later on we would say that it's 8,000 verses. And that later on that became its name, but it wasn't at first. Ashtasahasrika. And then like about 100 years later, they got the same text. A tiny, like 99.9% the same. They got another translation of the same text. Okay, that's cool. A better translation. The old translation was pretty terrible. You get a new one. If it's not too much trouble. And then another 100 years later, they got a new version of the same text. Hey, but they got a different one as well. It's basically got the same name. It's also called Prajnaparamita, but it's three times the size. Oh, that's interesting. It's the same text, and a lot of parts of it are the same, but this bigger one's got like extra stuff. Yeah. Oh, that's really interesting.
Can you give me the dates on this so far?
For the translation?
Yeah. 179. Okay.
That's the first one.
And the second one was?
Second translation.
About 100 years later, you said?
250. And then 370.
370 for the?
Same one, same text.
Okay.
Latest version. And 400. So you can see, like, you know, over a couple of centuries, that they got new, the texts would come in and say that original translation was just so terrible, no one could understand what the hell it was talking about. So let's do it again. Okay. And then, around the time of about 250, then we also get a new one, which is it's not really, but you might as well write the Panchasahasrika, because that's what nowadays people call it. It's not, but we'll
do that.
Yeah. So it's a bigger version. Oh, okay, that's interesting. I wonder what the relation is here. The Buddha seemed to give the same teaching, but with some extras. Okay, that's interesting.
Is this similar or parallel in the Pali with the Visuddhimagga? What was the other one?
The Muttimagga?
The Muttimagga, yeah.
No, because if pretty much every line of the Muttimagga was included in the within the Visuddhimagga, it would be the same. But it's not, is it? It's kind of a similar model, but it's...
Down.
Well, it's not just cut down, it's different content.
It's a different text, yeah.
Yeah.
It's the related
text,
similar
text. That's like a similar style text, but no, I mean, this is like, you know, if you compared the two, oh yeah, the opening line's exactly the same, but then the larger version adds quite a few other paragraphs, and then it's got a bit which lines up with the smaller one again.
What's the Sanskrit
for that?
It's not the
Panchasastrika. Yeah.
That's
5,000
lines.
Panchadamsati.
Oh, Panchadamsati.
And then in about the year 400, they got the really amazing translator called Kumarajiva. Kumarajiva kind of revolutionized Chinese translation style. I'll spend a couple of minutes talking about Kumarajiva. The story is originally his father was an Indian monk who ended up getting married to some Central Asian princess. They're always princesses, aren't they? Princes and princesses. And then, so he was born to this, and then he became like a novice at like age 7 or as early as you can. By his, you know, by the time he was 20, he was already a very well-recognized Shaivaisvada Abhidharma scholar, you know, by the age of 20. He had all the best teachers, obviously, because his mum is a princess. Oh, his mum became a nun. And even at a very young age, it's very amazing. And at some time, quite early, probably in the Buddha's 30s, he had a conversion to Mahayana. And cut a long story short, it was a funny story, but I'll cut it short anyway. He ended up in China. He was basically taken prisoner. He ended up in China, and he then did a lot of translation, and he didn't just translate, he could teach it, he really understood the stuff. So in about the year 400, they had new versions of these two as well, plus a commentary on this one, you know. And then about another 100 or so years later, they have more versions of the same, plus a version that's 100,000 lines. Now, I'm telling you, 100,000 lines is like, how big is it? You know, you translated that, it's like, you know that Bhikkhu Bodhisamyutta Nikaya? You know, it's like maybe 5 or 6 or 10 of those end to end. It's kind of like this big.
Is a commentary being added? Is this a commentary that's being added?
Okay, so this is the question. Now, because these texts are ostensibly all taught by the Buddha, and this is how the Chinese understood them, and basically how the Mahayana understood it, well, it's all said by the Buddha, and the main character is Subhuti. So they basically said, oh, the Buddha gave the same teaching many times, and he was so clever he could basically repeat certain bits verbatim, but sometimes he would give more details than others. That was basically the traditional understanding. Modern understanding says, well, no, quite different. Look at when they first appeared. The first version appeared as this one. And, you know, literally it is the earliest version. But what happened is at some point, someone came along and added a whole lot of stuff to this one, you know, to make it the 25,000 line. And then a few centuries later, somebody added a lot more and bulked them up, right? So basically, it's the small text is the essential one. Over centuries, it got bulked up. How and why is a bit of a big question. But basically, the bulking is not in the teaching or the message. The bulking up is in lists, right? So instead of saying form is not self, and so are the other four aggregates, full stop. You go, form is not self, and feeling is not self, and perception is not self, and volition is not self, and consciousness is not self. Earth is not self, water is not self, fire is not self, earth is not self, space is not self, consciousness is not self. Yeah, it's Abhidharma style, but the lists are of no known Abhidharma school, which makes it a bit more tricky. But anyway, so this is the bulking up process. In addition to the bulking up, sometimes whole new chapters are added. And the last point is, the very end of the text, there's like two chapters. And basically the chapter is about this idea of there's this young bodhisattva aspirant, called Sada Prarudita, which literally means ever weeping, always crying, who has this incredible aspiration to become a Buddha, and because they can't get the teachings, they cry, I can't get the Dharma, and so they have this great intention. Me too. We have a hero in common. Okay. That's how the story goes, literally. He goes through all these trials and tribulations to try to find the Dharma. And he gets directions to go to the city where there's a teacher called Dharmotgata, who gives him the teachings, and he has these great realizations, and he receives the Dharma. And then at the end, the Buddha says, just in the same way that this young guy sought for the Dharma, you too should also seek for the Dharma. That's his ideal. Okay, I'm going to get into how this all links together in a moment. Now, this is ostensibly tacked on the end of the sutra, as though it's the Buddha is saying, oh, well, you know, there was this other guy who da-da-da-da-da in order to get the Dharma. But if you look at the particular Avadana, Avadana literature, this Buddha biographical literature in other schools, you can find that there's a story of a past life of the Buddha which matches exactly with this story. Okay. They're just going to, you know, only the names have changed to predict the innocent or whatever it is, to predict the guilty, perhaps. For a start, I mean, this shows the importance of that Avadana literature, that Buddha biographical literature, and as the inspiration of the Mahayana, because that end chapter is inspirational, you know. It does kind of make, I've got to be willing to just die here to get enlightened. It doesn't matter, dying is no problem. Samsara is the problem, right? This kind of attitude. Is the inspiration. Yeah.
Just for those of you who were at the ABS conference in December, don't you remember the Chinese monk there gave a paper on exactly this topic, the relationship between the Siddhartha Rabhita
in the Avadana
Paramita and the Jataka.
Oh, okay, cool. Maybe. Well, actually, the blood does feature as an interesting theme within the story. Okay, so this is the earlier stuff that we've got on, but most people would say, but look, this text itself is like really huge and thick. You know, it's probably at least as thick as this. You know, it kind of been the earliest teaching simply because we can't imagine that they would have just, from the word go, had this huge teaching. So there's been big arguments about the earliest part. And it's basically believed that some scholars say the first half a chapter, some say the first whole chapter, some say the first two chapters of this text, that's the real core essential part of the Mahayana. And this is a whole chapter in my dissertation. So I could talk about it, but I might get it weird. I think it might be interesting to talk about it because I can talk about a particular idea which has implications beyond just this literature. And this idea was pointed out to me by Professor Lewis Lancaster. As we know, early Buddhist teachings weren't literature, they were oral teachings, right? They were orally transmitted. Now, oral transmission has certain characteristics, you know. People say, the repetitive nature of sutras is because it helps recitation, right? This is kind of a standard idea, you know, we have. And things like waxing syllables. If you've got a long list of terms.
Yeah?
Oh, okay. So you've got an idea about this idea? Okay. So you've got these sorts of ideas here in oral literature. Now, as far as I know, this has never been identified in Buddhist literature. So if I'm correct, my PhD might actually get a few thumbs up, and if I'm totally wrong, I'm just a laughing stock. But there's this one idea that comes up in oral literature worldwide, and it's been shown very clearly in other places, which is called chiasmus. You know how to write chiasmus? C-H-I-A-S-M-U-S. C-H-I-A-S-M-U-S. It comes from the Greek letter chi, which is like X, and it means like crossover. Sometimes it's called ring structure or ring composition. Sorry? Yeah, okay. So basically the idea that goes like this is that an oral teaching, okay, at least not just think Buddhism for now, but like oral traditions, storytelling is the best example. And remember, early Mahayana stuff, a lot of it was like storytelling, stories about the Buddha, begins from some particular quest or mission or problem. Yeah? You always got to have that for a good plot. It goes along a journey, and then it gets to a point in the journey which is like the turning point of the journey. After the turning point, the story comes back, and it gets to the end where the problem is resolved. Three main points. Starting point, the problem. The turning point, the cross point. That's why it's called chiasmus, the cross point. And the resolution of the problem. And it's not just like, this is why it's called a ring, because it kind of goes in a circle. But not just that it has these three points, but possibly in order to aid memorization and telling of the story and the way we hear things and process it on a very subtle level, if the story goes from A, that's our problem, then it goes B in the plot, C, D, E, F, G is the turning point. Da, 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 da. Then the next part of the story is F. It mirrors the F as we go into the story, E, D, C, B, A, the resolution of the A. The A, B, C, D, E, F, and the F, E, D, C, B, A are not identical, they are complements of each other. Because you've already got, you know, this is like the challenge and this is like the resolution. They match each other and they parallelize each other. Now, why do I mention this? And this is, as I say, part of my own research. Yep.
Can I just interrupt that? And it's very, very interesting because I've been doing an analysis of the Buddha's life story in terms of Joseph Campbell's hero myth. Joseph Campbell's hero myth is established on exactly the same structure, the
personal
structure, going out,
The
adventure, resolving the problem, and then the return.
Was there any particular reason why you chose the hero myth? Or you just, just a Campbell fan?
Various kinds of reasons, partly that, partly because it was very striking how, what I found was that in Joseph Campbell himself used, I think, the Lolita Vistara quite a lot as quoting from him. That was one of his paradigms for the hero myth when he constructed his book.
The Hero of a Thousand Faces.
But actually, when I was looking in the Pali canon, you actually see that actually most of those episodes and ideas which Campbell's talking about are already present in the Pali canon, but they're not consciously assembled into a structure. They're in one form or another, but they're not fully assembled.
So this sort of pattern, and it's been proven, like in, there are so many examples, like in biblical studies. There was this whole huge chunk of the Old Testament that scholars were like arguing about, oh, where did it come from? The story is just crazy, and this is later, and this is earlier, and blah, 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 blah. And somebody came along and just said, look at this whole huge five books of the Old Testament are this beautiful, perfect ring of the Jews being cast into exile, all these, their struggles. They have the covenant, which is, the spiritual realization, coming back down to they find their promised land. And as soon as they see that, bam, suddenly this whole huge part of the Bible just makes so much more sense. And of course it put a lot of, like, all these scholars out of a job because they didn't have anything to argue about anymore. But Lewis Lancaster analyzed the story at the end, the Avadana, and he used the analogy of the hero myth from Campbell. Now, but it's not just the hero myth. In my own studies, I won't go into all the details, later versions of the story don't follow the pattern. The pattern's broken up. But if you take some of the early versions of that text, you find, and I am getting back to answering your question about the blood, you find that on the way into the story, one of the ideas is that he wants to go to the teacher, and he needs to, in good Indian fashion, he needs to bring along something to give to his teacher, right? The teacher's gift, right? But he doesn't have anything. So he offers to sell his own body, his own flesh. This is very Jataka style, right? Sell your own flesh and your own body. Well, for the Dharma, right? It's worth it. We all know that. We've all hacked off limbs. I'm sure you have. And so he does this, and then he gets the, to cut a long story short, he gets the gift, and then Sakra is so impressed. Okay, the god Sakra is so impressed. He says, I will make your body whole again. And he says, don't worry. Look, if I'm really a bodhisattva, the fact, just the kind of statement of truth. If you make a statement that something that is true, it has this power of working miracles, like Angulimala's helping the pregnant woman. Since I was born as an Arya, right, into the dispensation, I have never killed, it's Angulimala, come on, we need that clause. I have never killed, may this woman and her child be healthy. Bam, it has this positive. Similar idea. He uses that statement to cure his own hacked up limbs to draw this blood to sell to get the price. And then on the second half of the story, and when he was cutting this blood, it's because Mara is there thwarting him and blocking him. Then on the other half of the story coming down the other way, Mara causes this huge dust storm to blow through the city, and they want to damp down the water, and Mara blocks out all the water, so they cut themselves with knives, and sprinkle their blood on the ground to calm the dust. And then Sakra is so impressed, he comes back and they cures his body. This is just one example of these two parallels on either side in the Jataka. I can give you more. I've got whole big files on an analysis.
It's also, I mean, just sorry to keep interrupting, but it's also really interesting how exactly those kinds of parallels you can see forming in the Buddha's own biography, even in the Agama versions. Say, for example, the Chattisparisat Sutra and the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, and sort of developing these whole series of parallel karma, which are quite conscious, like, say, the passage where the Buddha says he won't pass away until he's established the fourfold assembly, you know, which you find both in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, referring back to just after his enlightenment, and then it's there.
Literally over his whole life.
Yes.
The problem, and then he has solved the problem. His resolution.
And say, for example, references to Alara Kalama in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, where you these episodes from the very beginning of the Buddha's life are then mirrored. And then, of course, some very curious ones, like the Buddha's illness, because the Buddha eats and gets ill in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, which is very famous and in all the versions of that. But then
Before his enlightenment, there's taking of the meal?
Also before the enlightenment, when he took his meal, he also got sick. In the Sanskrit version, in the Mulasavastivana, Chattisparisat Sutra. So you know that motif is quite deliberately, consciously introduced there.
Yeah. Well, great. That's because I've been looking for other, you know.
There's some restoration stories with the Teri guitar. The king pulls her eye out and says, "Here, you want that? You like that, don't you?" And then she gets back to the Buddha, and it's like. Eye comes back again.
Mm-hmm. Idea. And so that's in there. And then also in the first two chapters of the text, you find there's another very beautiful parallel. And once again, it begins, the text begins very traditionally. Thus I've heard at one time the Buddha was saying it, that, okay, we know all this part. But then the actual, so that's kind of like that's not really the start of the sutra. That's like a bigotry. But the question is, it begins with the Buddha saying, turning to Subhuti and saying, "Oh, Subhuti, you who delight in the Dharma, teach the perfection of wisdom for the Bodhisattvas, such that they may practice it and go forth." Okay, so what does that mean? And then it gets into Subhuti starts giving his answers and so on. Now, it's kind of and then there's this kind of question, is it really Subhuti who is going to teach this? You know, Shariputra supposes, is it Subhuti who teaches, or does he teach through the Buddha's power? And then the response is that whatever they teach, they teach through the power of the Buddha. But what do they mean by that? It's not like, you know, see the thing, like the Buddha's like, you know, like a puppet show, you know? Like a sock puppet, it doesn't mean that at all. And then he goes on to say, because whatever Dharma they have trained in, they've realized it, and they speak from that understanding in a way that does not contradict Dharmata, the nature of Dharmas. Okay. This itself has its own implications about how the Mahayana themselves understood what it meant to say taught by the Buddha. It didn't, for a start, it didn't necessarily mean taught by the historical Buddha, but teaching from the position of realization, which is the same as the Buddha. Yeah, there's a lot of serious implications here. Now, at the end of the second chapter in the text, and this is what I think is the end of the loop, is Subhuti gives this teaching, and then the Buddha says, "Excellent, excellent." All the devas and the brahmins come out and go, "Yay, wonderful!" And they throw their flowers and they do all that sort of divine stuff. As they do. I'm sure you have Davis throwing flowers over your kuti on regular intervals.
Well, we do. And just to raise a question here, like when we did chanting at Bodh Gaya a couple of years ago, and we were chanting, and we actually have, as it happened, we were chanting one of those Diga suttas where that's all happening and all the Davis coming down and so on and so forth. Now, as it happened, purely by coincidence, at the same time, a huge group of Thais arrived, all dressed as devas, right? With all the headdresses and garments and all dressed as devas and brahmas and all of the kind of things, and came and did exactly that. It's just they were performing the text that we were reciting in Pali, because they had no idea what we were reciting, right? And they came down and did this almost like this theatrical presentation of the very text that we were performing as we were doing it. And I'm kind of wondering to what extent, because we talked before about the stupa and the role of the fairs and the festivals, how much these things actually did happen in terms of physical festivals.
Yeah. And so when we were talking about the devas came out, you know, are we literally, are we symbolic and stuff? This is still, you know, not clear. I wouldn't want to go 100% either way. Now, and also, as we know in the suttas, when the devas come out, it's something that's very important has happened. It's like a punctuation in the story, right? You look in different suttas where devas appear, or earthquakes. That's always a big one, right? I'll get to that in a moment if we have any time. And at the end, so they come out in the scapegoats, and then the Buddha says to Subhuti, excellent, excellent, you know, the way that you have taught is exactly, you know, is exactly the same as in the past, in the city of Pushpavati, when Dipamkara Buddha gave me the declaration to future Buddhahood. You know the story of Dipamkara? Who's, you know, in this biographical literature, it's a gazillion eons in the past that the Sakyamuni, the Bodhisattva, you know, on the path, and well, I can't go into this, that's a long story, but, you know, and it's in Dipamkara says, you will in fact become a Buddha. So this itself, once again, we've got the connection to the Sabadana literature. You've also got the fact that it's this kind of like empowerment or passing on of authority. Mm-hmm. Saying, at that time, Dipamkara is not making me a Buddha, but saying that I will become a Buddha. And in that literature, it was very important that to become a Buddha, you have to have this from a past Buddha. You know, if you don't, you just can't do it. You've got to have the thumbs up and this declaration. You get it from many Buddhas. Because as so long as one's a bodhisattva, whenever there's a Buddha who appears in the world, you will come and be a monk in their dispensation. You know, this was a very pervasive idea. And the start of the text, which is in effect, the Buddha is in a way empowering Subhuti. Okay, these are two key points. Now, like I say, it's not just a two key points. There's a central part as well, which talks about three key questions. One is basically, what is a bodhisattva? What is a mahasattva? And what is the Mahayana? Now, in addition to these, literally on either side going up, they're just parallels all the way. There are, how many have I recorded? There's like 10 parallels either way. And when you look at it in that detail, it's so clear that it is this structure, which was a very standard structure for the oral literature. Now, that appears in the first two chapters, and appears in the last two chapters, which is in the Avadana, but the rest of the text, all that stuff in the middle, doesn't have this structure. So what does this mean? My own take is that at first it was oral, and that's why it preserved that structure. And the Avadana was oral too, and it preserved that structure. And perhaps they were together, or perhaps they were separate. But then all that bulk stuff in the middle has come later, probably when it's a written text. Because the way you add things into a written text is different to how you add them into an oral story. Yeah? So this is something you can, in other words, use that structure to identify the earlier parts of a text and the later parts of the text. Possibly. Okay.
I have just add to that. I mean, that sounds a very reasonable, and obviously, you know, you have to explain the enlargement of the text as a process of gradual growth. However, I mean, at the same time, I would bear in mind that I mean, it's very interesting to identify those structural components of a text. But I think it's also the case that those structures can be used in that way from the very beginning. So in other words, you can establish, once you've established a clear structure of a beginning and an end with mirroring and so on and so forth, you've got a firm foundation. And then an oral literature can then start to bung all kinds of things in there while the structure is still strong.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just saying that this is another
topic. Yeah, definitely.
But I mean, obviously, you know, the historically, obviously, the text has grown, so that's very interesting.
So But then when we go from the smaller one to the big one, like I say, the bulking up tends to be such that it's the start of the text, the first chapters are the places that get most of the bulk, and then the later parts get less of the bulk. Okay, this follows the way in which a commentary or an explanation is given. I mean, I'll hazard a guess. You're studying the Shramanapala Sutta at the moment? Yeah? Did you find that, like, when you first begin, or when you start to do that with any sutta, that to explain the first few passages, you spend a long, 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 long time, but as you get later on in the text, you just kind of skip over things much quicker?
Oh.
Yeah? Yes, something like that? Yeah. So this is the same change that is shown in that bulking up. Yeah? You know what I mean? The added stuff is mainly at the start. One line of this, the first line of this becomes pages of this. The second line of this becomes pages of this. But by the end of this, it's one line is one line is one line is one line. Skipping over it as you go. Okay. Anyway, that's pretty... I don't want to get into how it expands, because that's kind of pretty dry. But then, coming back to the early core part, which has this idea of this, I call it like empowerment, or this passing on of this authority to teach the Dharma as sort of the prerogative of the Buddha, as reflected on one hand in the past by these past Buddhas saying that of Shakyamuni, you know, in the future you will become a Buddha. And being reflected in the present, well, as far as the sutra itself understands the present, as Subhuti can also pass on these teachings. And he's empowered by the Buddha, but here empowered by the Buddha just means has the same understanding. This actually has some pretty serious implications, that first point in particular, in that it's Subhuti. Subhuti is one of the arahants who's teaching the Mahayana sutra. So one of the big questions has been, so the early Mahayana, did they really consider that there was this big gap or big difference in terms of the realization of the Buddhas and the Arahants? You know, often that distinction is enlarged over time, that, you know, the Buddhas somehow have a whole different enlightenment. But it seems from the this one here, it's no. And there are parts also in the early things, it basically says, whatever realization, you want to call it an arahant, or as a Pachika Buddha, or as a Buddha, as a, you know, a Samyaksam Buddha, it's all attained by the same way. It's the same enlightenment. So as far as the actual realization part, it's the same. Yeah? But the difference comes in the other parts. But I'll get to that in a moment. I was originally talking about the middle point of that core part of the sutra. The middle point is these three definitions. What's a bodhisattva? What's a mahasattva? And what's the Mahayana? This is getting a bit more into the content. Do you have any questions so far? Okay?
Yeah.
Keeping up okay? I don't want to like...
There's some things that I don't really understand.
What don't you understand?
They're just things I'm not familiar with, but
yeah, okay.
You guys sort of getting
it. You're kind of getting it. Hopefully this might be a bit easier, this bit. Okay. So Gizzy's like...
What these texts are.
What these texts are.
Yeah, what texts are you talking about?
The Prajnaparamita,
yeah,
the perfection of wisdom. Yeah. So it's usually considered to be one of the earliest Mahayana texts. And so, in that sense, some of its contents and its basic ideals are also applicable to Mahayana in general. Not always.
So that's about suttas that are considered Mahayana suttas?
Yeah. There's a whole group of them, but this is considered one of the most important ones. Okay. So it gives a couple of different definitions. So the first one it talks about, the first one is what is a bodhisattva? Okay, now these guys, okay, so these three definitions, all I can say is these people like to do a lot of wordplay. They must have just, I don't know, either playing around or just making jokes or something, I'm not 100% sure. But anyway, it says, the usual definition, the usual question is, how do we break up this word? We've got two parts, right? One is bodhi, which is pretty straightforward. What's that?
Awakening.
Awakening, okay. And how about this part? Being. Okay, so what's that in Pali? It's slightly different, isn't it?
Bodhisattva.
Yep, it's Bodhisattva. Okay. Now this is the Pali here, and how it's written in Pali is actually significant. That we have a Sanskrit text, and it uses this term. Probably these weren't first written in Sanskrit. They were probably written Prakrit. You know Prakrit?
Yeah.
Like Pali is a type of Prakrit. It's a natural vernacular Indian language. Sanskrit was this highly polished, very grammatical version. Pali is one of the Prakrits. Probably these texts were first written in some sort of Prakrit. Not Pali, but a different one. But probably quite close. So it gives, when it says, so what is the meaning of a, you know, Bodhisattva? The basic definition it gets is, and then it starts to make the joke. The thing is, the term Satta, okay, as living being, is pretty straightforward in Pali. But, okay, there's a difference here, okay? Sanskrit, you can't have a TTV. In Pali, you can't have a TTV, you're not allowed to. You can only have a TT, so you have a TTA. So these are equivalent. But there's this other term. There's another term in, which written in Sanskrit is Shakta. Shakta comes from a term which means to adhere to something. You could, in the negative sense, stick to something or cling to something. You could say that, you know, get a good grab on it.
So it's a verb.
It's a noun, but it's from a verbal. Yeah, adherence or something. Yeah, but it's from a verbal group. Okay, this is Sanskrit. But if you were to write this in a Prakrit, how do you write it? You write it like this, because in a Sanskrit you can have a KT, no problem. Sakta, that's perfectly fine Sanskrit. You can't do that in Pali. You can't have a KTA. You have to assimilate your K into your T. What do you end up with? TTA. So they're making a joke. It sounds as though the question is, what is an awakening being? But they don't read it as being. They say, oh, it's someone who is, and then they say, someone who is, so what happens when you put an A in front of an Indian word? It's going to be opposite, but it's a negation. Someone who is not attached.
Well, so that's attached.
Yeah, it would be like attached. Someone who is not attached is attached to Bodhi.
I thought that was the meaning of Satta, that in Pali the actual meaning of the word or the derivation of the word was, yeah, like to be like entangled or...
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And because you can do that when you look at the Pali, you know, Pali words still have Sanskrit roots. Prakrit words still have Sanskrit roots. But you could say it's either. If you just look, well, it could mean this, but it could also mean like that attached. It could be either way. So in the Pali version, they did also keep this idea. That definition is exactly the same as the Prajnaparamita Sutra definition. And I'll tell you what, that definition for Bodhisattva, you won't find anywhere else. But isn't that strange? That basically the only two places that you do find it, one is this early Mahayana Sutra, and where's the other one? This later Pali Theravada tradition, they keep that. That's a big question you can ask right there. My short and simple answer is probably this originally came from southern India, yeah, and Mahavihara in Sri Lanka were influenced more by southern India, so they also had that same definition. But other places you don't find it, so it wasn't very common. Yeah.
So are you saying that there's two different definitions of Bodhisattva? I'm sort of not quite on.
Well, it could be. To me, that is just a pun. It really is a pun.
Yeah.
So what's an enlightenment being? What's an enlightenment being? It's someone who's not attached to enlightenment. Now that kind of sounds okay in English, but when you say that in Pali, what is a bodhisattva? What is a bodhisattva? It is someone who is bodhisattva. Is a bodhisattva. You see what I mean? It's kind of it sounds a bit more like a joke, right? So this is one of the, you know, basic definitions. Someone who's non-attached. And then this is also the name of the, I said many of these sutras are samadhi sutras, they're based on a particular samadhi. The samadhi in the early Prajnaparamita is the samadhi of not being attached to any dharma. That's simply what it is. That's a simple definition. And so not being attached to any dharma is also applicable to who? It's applicable to an Arahant, it's applicable to a Pachi Buddha, it's applicable to a Sam Buddha, right? There's no difference. So in this sort of sense, there's also the implication that To them, Bodhisattva didn't mean only someone who becomes a fully awakened Buddha, but the term Bodhisattva could be used, in fact, to anyone who's trying to become enlightened, right? But that's only the first definition. What's the second definition? Then it goes on to the second definition, which is, what is a Mahasattva? So this is the second definition.
Great being.
Yeah, literally great being. Oh, but then we might think, well, but are they going to be really tricky on us and say that this is being, or are they going to try to make it attached? Someone who's not attached to being great or something? Okay, but here they go back to the normal definition, and they say, yes, it means being. So you can tell that they know the basic definition is being, awakening being, but their definition of not attached is wordplay. But it also has, it's got a doctrinal significance, right? So the idea of the Mahasattva is that someone who becomes the foremost of living beings, and someone who leads all living beings to liberation. Now, in this sense, it's got more of an implication of specifically a fully awakened Buddha. Yeah. So here it does have that. It does kind of make a distinction. Although what I just said about Bodhisattva could be any spiritual practitioner seeking awakening. But here, there's a distinction. It's not just anyone.
So this is like not a Brahma, a great Brahma. It takes an office. There's one of them. He's got a very secret role.
Oh, that's an interesting thought. Yeah, that could be like that. Yeah, as opposed to other Brahmins, you mean?
Well, other Brahmins.
And then there's the great Brahma.
The great Brahma.
Yep. That would be a good analogy. Thank you for that. I'll remember that. That's a bit more simple. And then the next one is about what is the Mahayana? Okay, now this is also pretty simple. I'm sure you know a basic definition. Okay, great. And then what does yana mean? Let me think of a vehicle, or conveyance. Now, it's this term in particular that's very important in the point that this whole literature is the Prajnaparamita. And this is what I should have done right at the very beginning. What does even the term Prajnaparamita mean? I should have done this earlier, aren't I? Great class plan I have. not at all. Okay, Prajnaparamita. Okay. The most standard, okay, I'm sure you know this term, right? What's this? Sorry, Shania. Not prana.
Oh,
okay. Prajna. The root is jnana, a bit like vijnana or jnana, right? To know, just to know. Pra, this prefix literally means actually like out, like prana, right? The prana is the out-breath, right? Ana is the in-breath. So the pra actually kind of means not really going out, but this kind of, I just kind of imagine it like that. Right? The paramita. So that's pretty straightforward. And the idea of panya in Pali, you know, wisdom is a very important idea.
So it's recognized wisdom.
Yeah, panya is exactly the same as yeah. But this suffix is very interesting. Now the Pali will usually talks about them. There's two ways to break it down. One is you say there's a word parami, which means like perfect or excellent. And then the ta is a abstract suffix, which makes it perfection. You know what I mean? Literally, you know, in English we add the word N-E-S-S on everything Buddhist, and it looks really weird because it's not very good English. But we use that to try to represent this suffix. Perfection. So one of the most common explanations you see is the perfection of wisdom. But actually, this isn't how the text itself, that's one way you can break it down, but that's not how the sutra itself breaks it down. The sutra itself breaks it down like this. Param, which means literally the other, but often the other shore, particularly in Buddhist context, the other shore, which is nirvana, right? Yeah, the other shore, nirvana. Across the ocean in the middle of samsara, the other shore is nirvana. This is a concept you'll find almost in this book. And then the ita comes from a root e, which means to go. And ita means gone. It's a past form of the word, gone. So wisdom has gone to the other shore. This definition is actually what it really means. It's not the perfection, the six perfections or the ten perfections. I mean, that's the way the Pali gives it, because the Pali talks about parami. But early on, this idea was the wisdom that makes you gone to the other shore, takes you to Nirvana. And once again, this is just as applicable to any spiritual practitioner. It doesn't make a distinction between a Buddha or a Pachyabuddha or an Arhant, right? Because all of them go to Nirvana. Now, the fact that this comes from the word e is significant. There's a similar one, which is, I'm trying to write that upside down, and it's probably confusing for my brain. There's another term. Ya, these are almost identical. E and ya, they're both in the same thing. Go. It's just a verb. Go. Mahayana, great. And this word yana comes from the same root. So then how do they define the Mahayana? It gives a couple of points, and let me see if I can actually try to remember them. It says that it goes out. Okay, basically, a bodhisattva is someone who sets out, and the word set out here means to, like, it includes the root to stand on it, like to get on it. They get on the Mahayana, you know, a bit like board. You get on the big vehicle, stand on it, get on the big boat, right? But they're standing, but they don't stand anywhere. Okay. They stand on the big boat, but don't stand anywhere. How does this great vehicle go? It goes out from the triple world. Okay, the triple world is the world of desire, form, and the formless. Right? So, actually these two ideas are very, very similar. When they say you stand on the great vehicle, but you don't stand anywhere, here they mean to stand, they mean to basically get attached to something, right? You take your stand on your particular view, or you take your stand on some position. Don't stand anywhere. That is great standing. How do you set out? Where do you go to? Right? And this is what it literally means, you know, it's going, this vehicle goes somewhere. You don't go anywhere in this triple world. You go out of the triple world. Where? Gone to the other shore. So these are ideas. There is quite a bit of wordplay, and it is quite sort of like, you know, if you read the Sanskrit, it's like, ooh, they're very clever. Obviously, they must have been quite gifted oral teachers themselves to be able to like make jokes like that. But they're always making these statements to the effect of, you should go, you know. Well, you take your stand. Where should you take your stand? Don't stand anywhere. What is a bodhisattva? A bodhi being is someone who doesn't sattva anywhere. They don't get attached anywhere. That's what it means to be attached to bodhi. To be attached to a bodhi is to not be attached to anything. Yeah? This idea, this constant asking of a question and using a, I don't even know if it's like a negation, but it's, I guess it is a kind of negation, but it's a tricky kind of negation that doesn't want to set up anything, doesn't want to set up any position or anything that you should do or any particular thought you should think about or any particular attitude that you should have. And only by having this attitude that one can go to the other shore and become liberated. Now, in many ways, this basic principle, a lot of the ideas, very, very similar to what you'll find in early suttas. Very, very similar. It's not a huge amount of it. Yeah.
Excuse me, I'm just wondering, in the Zen Buddhism and Tibetan Buddhism, do they have sutras?
Yes, they do. You'll find that the Zen tradition is itself originally from China, and the Chinese tradition were mainly based on Mahayana sutras. Mm-hmm. At one point, they got a bit iconoclastic in the sense of, well, you know, and this is a good example. Well, if you shouldn't stand anywhere, well, you don't even need to read the sutra, right? Right? If you start getting attached to the sutra, you've made a mess of it, right? So they would take that kind of understanding too. On one hand, Zen and the Chinese equivalent Chan will say a lot of things like that. You don't need sutras. Sutras are a waste of time. But, I'll tell you what, they'll say that. But every other word that they're saying is quotes from the sutras. So they're using it, but they're also saying don't be attached to it. You can use it, just don't be attached to it. Yeah? Tibetan Buddhism also has a basis in Mahayana sutras, but because the Tibetan tradition is later, they tended to come at a time when there were these treatises and explanations that were very systematic, and most of the Tibetan traditions are based on that. But those systematic teachings themselves also owe a lot to these principles, so they tend to be less directly connected. But the Chinese traditions are very much grounded in Mahayana sutras. That's the you know, basic words.
And the Theravada sutras?
Theravada? Yes, very much so, but not these ones. Different ones. Very different ones.
So which would be worldwide? Which would be the ones that are most taught?
It really depends on where you go. Theravada tradition, obviously they use their own systems, so that's your South Asia. In East Asia, they also have equivalents of those, but very, 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 very seldom teach them, but teach the Mahayana ones instead. So it's very hard to, there's kind of no universal ones. But hopefully I'm trying to get to the point that some of the very basic ideas and concepts aren't necessarily radically that different. But, again, time is running out, so I have to try to... Have I answered your question then?
Yeah,
okay. But I must say, over time, this is the early, early strata of the Mahayana. Over time, like those other sorts, that distinction between the Buddha as someone who practiced this, the Mahayana, to attain fully amazing, complete and perfect, wonderful awakening, and the sort of other, these other practices that only lead to liberation, you know, only lead to liberation. You know, the distinction grew and grew, and probably for those communities, the people within the community, some people would recite these sutras and others wouldn't. So even within the communities themselves, they would start to do some teachings. And at some point, and not even at some point in some places, but not necessarily everywhere and at all times, there would be some antagonism between them. By the course of history, that, you know, it just ended up that the Mahayana teachings were the dominant ones in China as opposed to South Asia. And for hundreds of years, their contact was so minimal. But both sides were painting a picture of the other. I don't know what they're basing it on. You know, a lot of it was just imagination about what the other people were like. And of course, it was always bad. So there was this sort of straw man argument, you paint a bad guy with other bad guys. My personal take on the modern day is, you know, a lot of us are simply not understanding each other. So I personally like to take the time and try to understand the other tradition. And I'm very glad to be here today, and I wouldn't have thought I'd end up be talking about this, you know, Thai forest monastery, quite inconceivable. But anyway, thank you for being an inquisitive audience. Dharma in the West, we've got a lot of different traditions and we're going to meet. And if we know more about each other before we meet, it can help so much.
But then how does this idea of like not attached to even the enlightenment relate to the very early suggestion that you have of where Mahayana come from, that they try to distinguish themselves from the supergroup and being these people want to meditate and think this ideal? And how does this transfer into this not attaching?
There is also another more subtle level as well, and it could be related to things, for example, that there were some schools, particularly Abhidharma schools, that tended to define, one of the key ideas in Abhidharma is what we call Dharmavada, Dharma theory. And most Dharmas are conditioned Dharmas, right? The aggregates, mind, physical matter. But you also have unconditioned Dharmas. Theravada version says there's only one unconditioned Dharma. But there really is Dharma, and it's Nibbana. There's something called Nibbana, and we can attain that. So these people, and it wasn't just these people, there were a lot of other schools that said, well, yeah, we talk about Nibbana, but it's not something that you have some connection with, and that's Nibbana. What's Nibbana? It's the extinguishing of craving, aversion, and delusion. Well, even the early suttas themselves, even the early Pali suttas, give one definition of that. And so a lot of other schools would say, okay, Nibbana, yes, there is this term, and there is such a thing as the elimination of defilements, but it's not a thing, it's not a dharma, you know what I mean? And so you say, you clean up the house. Okay, there's dirt in the house, so you clean it up. When you get rid of the dirt, it's not that you get this new thing called cleanliness, right? Cleanliness is just simply the absence of dirt, yeah? So when it comes down to this idea of not being attached, they would say, you guys, the imaginary out there, there's always some other guys, right? You guys, you think that there's something called enlightenment, and you're looking for it, and you're hankering for it. And I'll tell you what, there's no such thing as this enlightenment that you can hanker after. Just drop it. Just stop attaching to anything. That is enlightenment. Does that make any sense?
It sounds like they could have just come up with that just by sort of like scholarly thinking about it, right? Like
which one? The idea that it is a...
The idea that it's not actually a dharma, that it's just, you know, the absence of something. Like, you know, because it makes sense on like a theoretical level, but as far as I know from hearing people talking who they repeatedly attend enlightenment, they do talk about like something that, you know, their mind abiding in something else that is not accessible to the normal being.
And you'll also find some other traditions and other stories of people who have also reputedly attained it, and they'll say, yeah, but as soon as you start talking about it being something, you're already off track. You know what I mean? Because then you start to get into that realm of prapancha, conceptual proliferation. Yeah. If you, and I think here, so is it or is it not? You know, this is the big trigger of the Buddha. Does it exist or does it not exist? What does the Buddha say? Exactly. Yeah. So, although on one hand they're giving a critique of a group that on one hand is saying it does exist. And they're kind of saying, well, they're not saying it doesn't exist. That's the thing. But it's possible from their position to then just say that it doesn't exist.
Yeah.
These are all positions. You're taking a stand, right? How do you stand in Mahayana? Don't stand anywhere. So this is kind of the gist. And it is that they use it in nakaschis, dapiyati or something, nakaschis. Not anywhere. Not on anything. And that includes existence or non-existence, up, down, left, right, red, yellow, blue, green, or whatever. So there's something in that too, but yeah, but still, even that's easy to misinterpret, isn't it? So I think there were, on some other levels, there were some fundamental doctrinal differences of perception. But this is only one Mahayana teaching. There are other Mahayana teachings that are very much like, yeah, there really is something out there like that. So my perspective is that they were different Mahayanas that came from different doctrinal bases to begin with. Yeah, this was one that came from one that tended towards that. No, it ain't that. No, not that either. So it's nothing. I didn't say that. Right?
I think it's here before it was unhelpful. It says no enlightenment, no pain to the environment.
Yeah. But in the modern day, like if you read the Heart Sutra, there's a lot of translations of the Heart Sutra that give you this idea that, and I've scarily encountered what I believe to be far too many people that give you this position of, oh, real awakening is to know that there is no awakening. Like on one level, I can go, yeah, okay, kind of like that. But on another level, you know, if I ask my mother or something, is there such a thing as awakening? She'll probably go, I don't know, I don't think so. Oh, so she must be awakened. You know, well, okay, you know, you can very easily go horribly wonkily off course on that one, right? But there are some, and these people are Buddhist teachers. That would be a sort of a non-existence extreme. A complete denial that there is no such thing as the truth of cessation.
There seems to be the event of awakening and a Buddha experience, our heart's experience, you know, the imagination, mind experience, and the event of awakening. So things that really point to every time and place.
Yeah, there's a lot in there, but that's the thicket of views of sectarian Buddhism. And if you really want to sort of get a gist of the Mahayana position, for my own studies, I've only learned so much. Don't worry, before Mahayana, look at all those other different schools. A huge amount of crazy ideas, and see what they were. All the other schools are talking about before the Mahayana. Then you see where they're coming from. It's not. Then I don't end up going like, oh, Theravada Abhidhamma sees Nibbana as an unconditioned Dharma. They're kind of saying neither nor. Therefore, these two were against each other. No way, man. There were a zillion other views as well. You know, it wasn't necessarily Theravada versus Mahayana. That's like so simplistic. It's just a bit ridiculous.
So does the kind of early Mahayanas know or think that their early suttas are not by the Buddha but by this group of pilgrimage?
Well, that's a very interesting question. But from what it appears, they believe, yeah, it is. Now here I use a technical term, the word of the Buddha. But like I said, how does this teaching define word of the Buddha? That which comes from someone who's also had that same realization, you know. So the word of the Buddha doesn't necessarily mean from Prince Siddhartha, who then became the Buddha, and what he says, that's the word of the Buddha, and anything else from anyone else is not the word of the Buddha. Do you understand? Well, not really. You know? And even in the Pali canon, you know, you'll find teachings that weren't given by Gautama, right? The teachings by, even some of them are after the Buddha's parinibbana, Ananda gives a teaching or something. It's sutta, it's the word of the Buddha. Why? Well, it conforms to the point. So that's also another, you know, idea to keep in mind as well. Of course, you can take that too far as well. Well, I'm enlightened, so anything I say, that must be the way to do it.
I was just wondering the explanation given to the Mahayana teachings is still something which I believe teaches us to actually practice the Dhamma Vinaya, so to speak. But from what I observe in the present day Mahayana temples, the practice is more towards like chanting and rituals and festivals and all that, and they call the Mahayana's teachings.
Mm-hmm.
When did that start to happen?
That's a process of hundreds of years. Like I say, at first they were a marginalized group that didn't have the power. Now when it gets into China, as things build up, they become the dominant force. And then Chinese Buddhism, and China is, you know, huge. So every sort of way, shape and form, from the best to the worst of practitioners, you know, you'll find it there somewhere. But I think one of the ideas is that because the early teachings themselves extolled and said about how much merit you can get from reciting the sutra, do you remember at the start of the class I talked a bit about that? And that's on one hand, so if I recite it there's a lot of merit. And on the other hand, that the idea of dedication of merit to all living beings and this idea of compassion, that, you know, that the Bodhisattva path was for the benefit of others. So they kind of, you know, like, do your sums and they say, well, then the best thing we can do is you recite the text, there's a whole truckload of merit, and you dedicate it to living beings. And so this would kind of be, you know, it would be easy for them on this sort of reasoning to come to that sort of conclusion. Yeah.
Why is it that the Mahayana tradition is like always linked to the Avalokiteshvara? Why is this link there? Why is this
wrong? Okay. Well, it's quite interesting. Like I said, this sutra, this is very early, and the key figure is in Sanskrit Ugra, but in Pali Ugra, also appears in the early canon as well. So, and just like this sutra uses Subhuti, who appears in the early canon, they would use these early figures. Now, my take goes something like this. Probably not long after the Buddha's time, there would have been a lot of great practitioners, as you can imagine, you know, at the Buddha's time and after the Buddha's time. And some of them would have been the prototype models for what went on here. But just as the Buddha himself went from, you know, just became, had all these, you know, superhuman attributes added, likewise too, probably some of those early practitioners would have had more and more things added to them. And originally they might have this idea, okay, I too want to be a Buddha, but then it would be, oh wow, they wanted to be a Buddha. Well, you know, the Buddha himself, he had these past lives and did these amazing things. And so their avadanas and Buddha biographical literature, they then started creating some for these bodhisattva aspirants too. And so it built up these huge personality cults, right? You know, wow, that figure, that amazing. The Buddha himself was so amazing, so amazing. Well, somebody else's, they're a bodhisattva too, and they've done all these things and all these past lives and da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Developed these huge personality cults. And because they were attributed with such power, it then started, there was one point where it made this turn, rather than the Buddha teaches the Dharma and we apply the Dharma and become liberated, that these bodhisattvas can actually liberate us. You know, it becomes a shift. And so the fact is not so much on then how do we practice, but Avalokiteshvara save me. And I make offerings to you and you save me. I mean, it's the ism all over again, isn't it? But this is a tendency that people have, popular level. You know, we always want someone to save us, except ourselves. I think I'm already like over time, but are they sitting downstairs like strumming their fingers going, is he still talking? Okay. So first two.
Okay.